One of the best things about the 21st century has been the variety of creative ways radio has evolved.
Really? That's one of the best things? It's not been the best century, then.
It's been slim. But the legacy of Marconi is in good hands with Alex Lefchik and the Midweek Drivettes. So we got that going for us.
Which is nice.
77 England caps and probably part of the greatest Ipswich Town side that the world has ever known. And I'm speaking, of course, of the awesome legend that is Terry Butcher, manager extraordinaire, footballer extraordinaire. It's a genuine delight and a privilege to welcome you to the Midweek Drive. Terry, good to see you. How are you?
I'm fine, Alex, and the check's in the post for that introduction. Thank you very much.
Genuinely, I think there are sort of times that I think back over. The ideal dream centre-back partnership for me would have always been Terry Butcher, Kevin Beattie, probably Russell Osman as well, but Butcher and Beattie very much at the heart there, and Alan Hunter, of course. But that's by the by. In another era and another time of greatness and so on. Here we are a few days after the result which obviously saw Italy have huge satisfaction and happiness, etc. And England, less so, but we're getting there. Clearly the message of this particular piece, which is going to speak about people's mental health, well-being, anxiety as we head back to the office and so on, and other workplaces, etc., is at the heart of it there. But I'm sure, Terry, you will have had huge empathy, being part, of course, of the 1990 classic experience, and of course, you know, England under Bobby Robson as well, about the kind of emptiness that sort of feels, where you just think, oh, what, you know, so close and yet so far.
Yeah, it's a usual story for England, though, isn't it? Not to get to finals, but when you get to a final, you want to win it. And there is nothing worse than losing a final. I mean, losing a semi-final is horrible, but having got through the semi-final and into the final, you want to win it. There's no point being there unless you want to win it. So, the players, met from a mental point of view, it'll take a bit of time to get over it. But, they, you know, as in football, there's another game. There's another game coming. There's another competition coming. And there's always something on the horizon that you have to, you know, get over the previous job and the previous experience and then look forward. And I think that's when England do lose and do go out of competitions, there's always the inquest afterwards, what went wrong, etc., and all that sort of thing. I think we're going through that, or we have gone through that now, 2 days afterwards. But we're now into the stage of, well, you know, look at the next competition. It's the World Cup next year, which is coming around pretty quick because of COVID. And you look at the squad and you look at the way that they went about their work in preparation for this tournament. And you say, well, England at long last, I feel, are now right up there with all the big guns. They're right up there and they now have a genuine chance of winning championships or World Cups, European championships. They have a great chance, whereas before, it was always might be. Now you sort of think, they will be in the last four. They will be there or thereabouts, and they can win it even more so than before. So we've gone up another level, I think, with Gareth, to a position which we haven't been in for some time, but a position where we can, you know, now go on to really be serious contenders for winning the World Cup and winning the European Championships again.
And of course, as with all sports, it starts in the mind, it ends in the mind. People talk about, obviously, perfect training, physical training, and so on. I mean, looking at the recent study that we're talking about in terms of 1 in 5 British folk are feeling anxious about socialising again. It's so difficult to be. I mean, in the 21st century, we have thankfully started talking about mental health issues in a way which does open up the dialogue. Because back in the day, and obviously the iconic image of yourself, Terry, with the blood and the headband and all of that, and going through the distance, etc. The kind of issues that come out of that, it's really important. It's not just obviously Prince William who's been keen to obviously stress this. It's at the heart of the whole sort of system of our lives as human beings, really.
Yes, and there's a lot more emphasis put on mental health now. And you know, in football, it's about preparation. You can prepare your body physically, you know, for any sport like the Olympics and everything else, but you have to be right, and you have to be of sound mind, as it was called years ago, where you have to be right mentally. And it's now very much an important part, as important the mental side as the physical side. So when you, and that applies not only to sport, but to life as well. And when you have something that happens to you that can set you back, like losing a final of any competition, like losing, you know, in a race, or losing a cricket match, or whatever it is, a game of dominoes, which is very, very small compared to the rest. But then, you know, it's like in life as well. You have a setback, but you've got to respond to that, and you've got to deal with that. And it's like this: the pandemic has been a huge setback. It's been tragic for many, many people. And a lot of people who are been shielding and are vulnerable as well, they have to come back into society because it's what we do. We're a very social species. So we have to make sure that the mental side is right as well. And I think with this new project from Well Pharmacy, it's the largest independent pharmacy in the UK. It's really good news that people have a place where they can go to, and they can relax. There's a little bit of a sanctuary. I think a lot of people may have wanted to go there during the European Championships just to get away from the football, but it's somewhere where you can go and you can get the literature on anxiety, Anxiety UK, for example, and then also speak to a pharmacist, and you know, you can have a phone call with your family and friends that you might not be able to speak to as well, just to socialise a little bit more, but also prepare yourself for getting back into a normal life, which we consider normal, which was obviously pre-pandemic. So the mental side now of everything that you're involved in is far more important and far more deep and harder work possibly than the physical side. So I welcome this from Well Pharmacy, but also as well, I understand where people are coming from, where they do struggle. And I think it's, whereas in my time, it was like, well, come on, man up, and what you're talking about, all this, you're depressed, but we're all depressed when we lose. But depression is a lot deeper than just saying, well, you're winning or losing, or you're doing well or not doing well, or it's raining or it's not raining, etc. We understand that a lot more now, but I still feel there's a lot more to understand and a lot more to get our teeth into. So little projects like the Well Pharmacy one, I think, are ideal and can certainly help. They can't hurt people. They can most definitely help them.
Mm, absolutely. I'm mindful of the fact that a few years ago, it was Malcolm McDonald who actually said, in football, when you guys go out on the pitch, you carry with you the vicarious hopes and dreams of all of the followers with it. That, and I think that is true. I think that's something that even now, as fans and footballers, we follow that from that point of view. And maybe that's something else we also need to talk about in terms of the way in which we actually deal with people and deal with ourselves. Really, we realise we're one team, and even more important when sometimes that team doesn't quite go according to plan.
Yes, that's right. But I mean, supporters they're very loyal. They're very strong. They desperately want their team to do well. And I think when you do go onto the pitch or you do go onto the competition arena in any sport, you do carry the hopes, you carry the responsibility, you carry everybody's dreams. And it's very difficult then, if you think about that and allow that to happen, then you allow that sort of weight to be a burden. Then you don't perform, you don't do what you should do. So you realise that, you've got to understand that mentally, you've got to sort of park that to one side and just concentrate on your instinct and concentrate on your knowledge and experience, and make sure that you give the best performance for people and make sure that you do them proud. And that was what we tried to do, and that's what the players are doing now. That doesn't change, but what does change is all the periphery around football games and sports and around life in general, I think. And you have to try and ignore that and try and push that to the back of your mind. So yeah, I think there are mind trainers now, aren't there? People that can train, that get, you know, get paid and help people to train their minds. Mm. And I think, we've got to look at something like that. But I think first and foremost, we've got to get the confidence. First and foremost, we've got to get back into a normality as quickly as we can. There's still problems, obviously, with the pandemic, that it's not gone away completely. But you still got, if we are allowed to, with Freedom Day on the 19th, and that's when these comfort zones will be available from the 19th. we can then, you know, look to say, right, we're gonna, you know, give it our best shot and try and get back into a normal life and do what we used to do and enjoy ourselves and enjoy meeting people. And everybody now, I mean, everybody you sort of look at, you wonder, have they got COVID? Have they had COVID? Are they going to get COVID? It's when you look at people through different eyes, but that will go eventually. But it needs confidence and it needs people and it needs yourself just to make sure that you can clear your mind.
And finally, Terry, just to actually head back and sort of look back in a pre-social media era, a time where effectively we sort of, it was almost an innocent time, really. But I'm thinking about 1986 and 1990. And, of course, Sir Bobby Robson, who himself actually had lots of abuse in the interim periods, of course, when he wasn't so successful in the European Championship. So I think we went there in 88 and so on and so forth. But what do you think Sir Bobby would be saying now? What would his advice be to Gareth Southgate if he's looking down, as I'm sure he is looking down at us and sort of saying, you know, what do you think he would actually be saying?
He would be praising him. He would put his arm around him. He would comfort him. And then he would say, right, you know, this is what you've got to do. And I think he'd be very proud of what he's done. He'd be very pleased with the way he's taken his England forward. Because he loved England, he played for England, and I think that he would say it would really highlight the good points and the good things of what Gareth is and what he does. And I think that he would reiterate the fact that, you know, he's done exceptionally well in the time he's been with England, and he's now turned England into a real power in the football world, whereas before it was. You know, on the edge, it was just about there, and now we're in that sort of elite group. So I think that he would be one that, for me in particular, he used to give me a lot of confidence, and I think that's something that you need someone that's going to be alongside you. I only wish that Gareth could have, you know, would have, if he had Bobby Robson alongside him, I feel, wow, what a team that would be, because Bobby then, you know, would help, and that's all he wanted to do. He wanted to help make people better, help make football better, help make life better. It would be brilliant if he was here to say that. But with Bobby especially, he would tell you straight. He would tell you where you were wrong or you could have done better in certain circumstances. But he wouldn't dwell on negativity. It would always be about positivity. And that way, I think he inspired people that he met and everybody that he met, he touched with grace and dignity and class. And Gareth has got an abundance of that as well.
And doubtless Sir Bobby will be coaching Paul Mariner when they're both up in heaven and are on the pitches at this very moment in time. Again, another tragic loss, but we carry on because that's what we have to do. Terry, it's been awesome sharing some thoughts with your good self today. It is, of course, the Comfort Zone scheme, which launches with Well Pharmacy that starts on the 19th of July. We've got two final questions. That would be almost crass in so many ways. It's been absolutely fantastic connecting with your good self. But Terry, have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us on the midweek drive today? Has it been okay for you?
Yeah, it's been great. Terrific. Thanks, Alex, very much. And hopefully people will take advantage of this and hopefully people will get back to normality as quickly as possible. But thank you very much.
Well, then the next critical question is, can we look forward to and invite you back again? Will you come back sometime and share some thoughts about Ipswich back in the day, Rangers, when you spoke about Rangers, etc. And the fact that at one stage, I'd seriously actually suggested you should be an ideal manager of a certain club that I'm very fond of, Manchester City. But that was back in the sort of pre-Etihad days. But there we are. So it goes.
Yeah. Yeah, Main Road and Kippax and all that. Yeah, great ground.
Exactly. Sorry, hopefully you return. Take care. Keep on keeping on and all the very best.
Thanks, Alex. Thank you.
774 feet in length, 58,250 tons, 54 cabins, and a crew of 540 and a maximum capacity of 999 people. All interesting metrics and referring very much to the fantastic cruise ship Spirit of Adventure, which is brand new and is literally about to actually engage in its maiden voyage. So we're delighted to actually welcome to talk about Spirit of Adventure and more the Chief Executive Officer of Saga Travel and Chief Strategy Officer, of course. That's Nick Stace. How are you, Nick?
Very well. Very nice to meet you.
Very good indeed. And now, I mean, this is very exciting, isn't it? I mean, this is all good news, a new ship for the ocean waves.
It is so exciting. And I have to say, it has been long in the waiting. So we were hoping to have our maiden voyage last year. And obviously the naming ceremony with it. But with the last 16 months, obviously everything's gone on hold. All of our lives have gone on hold, really. So this is, you know, we're all really thrilled and excited and rather emotional, actually, about today.
Well, I think also it ties in with the pandemic, of course, because the official who's actually going to be naming, the official naming, of course, of Spirit of Adventure is indeed the recently retired head of the Royal Navy Medical Service, Commodore Inga Kennedy. So good news there.
I mean, and, you know, the Commodore Kennedy is just a phenomenal person. I had dinner with her last night and she's, you know, she has run a team of thousands and thousands of medics who have been working right across the country, serving our country in the way they know best and at a time we've needed them most. And she's also someone, of course, of the ocean herself in the sense that, you know, she's been in a senior command position on the Royal Navy. So she is the most sort of symbolic, most perfect, really, godmother that we could hope for.
Now, this is actually the first time in history that a new cruise ship has actually been named at Portsmouth International Port. So the Portsmouth citizens must be beside themselves with glee, I would have thought.
Well, I know they are. I mean, and it's a wonderful thing. And I can't understand why we're the first, because this is a wonderful city. You know, the sun shines beautifully today. It's like the Caribbean down here. And why hasn't it happened before? I think we are making history today, because I think we will prove that Portsmouth is a great place to name your ship, and I hope others follow.
I mean, one tends to recall, if you're of a certain age, the excitement of the official ship naming, the launch, and so on. It seems in recent years to kind of fall out of favour. Do you think that's because more people were actually using alternative forms of transport and actually having something completely new in terms of, obviously, the shipping industry was less frequent than it used to be?
Well, actually, I think in funny sort of way, the reverse is true in terms of the demand. The demand for cruises is at an all-time high, and certainly was prior to going into the pandemic. And in fact, we are almost booked out, actually, for the summer period and starting to get that way for autumn and winter too. So the demand is very, very high indeed. The thing about ships is they last quite a long time, as you'd imagine. So, you know, this ship we think will be in service with us for about 30 years. So it's not a very frequent occurrence that you have a naming ceremony. But our fleet of two are both new. The Spirit of Discovery 2 years ago was named, and obviously the Spirit of Adventure today. So we've got brand new ships. They are boutique, they're luxury, they're affordable, which I'm delighted to say to our customers. And also, and really importantly, in the times in which we live in, they are safe. We have managed to create the safest environment in the world to see the world, and we're delighted to have done that.
That was going to be my next question, actually, Nick, because clearly there are concerns. I mean, it's literally, say, 18 months ago, and people were saying we're never going to go on a cruise ship again, because there were lots of nightmare stories coming out in terms of obviously being unable to get back to port, being isolated, all of those kind of things. Presumably, this is something which is very much a 21st century cruise ship, and all precautions are in place.
All precautions are in place. They are accredited by the Lloyd's Register, so third-party accreditation, who can do spot checks at any time. All of our guests, all of our crew have been double vaxxed, and there's no exception to that. So if you don't want to be double vaxxed, unfortunately, you will not be welcome on a Saga cruise ship. But, you know, we're doing that because our customers, 98% of them said that's important to them. 93% of them have said in a recent poll that actually they want to travel with other people who have been vaccinated. So Saga puts the health of our customers first is the number one priority, and it's really important we do that. But look, our ships are also actually strangely designed for a pandemic world. I mean, not that we knew we were about to go into one, but while we are small, 999 passengers in total, they are large in terms of the scale. There's a lot more space per passenger than most other cruise ships. Each of the cabins has fresh air conditioning. Each of the cabins also has a balcony. So it's not just fresh air from the outside coming in, although that's important, but it's also its own fresh air conditioning within the cabin and within the corridors. So it is as COVID secure as you could possibly get. And we will stop at nothing to make sure that that's the case.
And just out of interest, in terms of clearly we're very much focused on climates and climate matters and issues with respect to that as well. Is it also pretty much built with full sustainability and eco-friendly values in mind as well?
Yes, that was really important in the design of the hull, the design of the engine. Overnight, actually, by replacing the older ships that we had, we reduced our emissions by a third. And each moment in time, we are looking to new technology to reduce it further. But it also matters about the behavior on board as well. So, for example, we don't have single-use plastics. So we try and be at the cutting edge, really, of environmental change. And also, it matters how we actually drive the vessel. So if you're at full pelt all the time, that uses a lot more fuel and therefore creates many more emissions. Actually, we drive at really economical and ecological speeds to make sure that we can do the best by the planet as well as our customers.
Have you had the opportunity as the Chief Executive Officer to have a full tour of the boat as yet? And have you actually managed to effectively have a sort of sneak preview before, obviously, the official naming ceremony?
Yes, well, more than just a tour. I mean, I practically live on here at the moment, which is one of the greatest joys I have as Chief Executive. So I've been on for the last couple of nights. On our other ship, the Spirit of Discovery, a couple of weeks ago, I spent a week on it, traveling around the British Isles. So at the moment, I do have probably the best job in the world. I mean, it feels like it, at least, enjoying the pleasures of a luxury boutique cruise liner with unbelievable crew. We've got crew from 49 countries. They are the best crew, I think probably the finest in the world. They are kind. They create a wonderful community. And you just feel so incredibly cared for. And that's just a wonderful experience at a time when we've come through the most horrific period, 16 months of torture, I think, for the whole world. This is the moment we hope when the country, the world will begin to open up and we can welcome people back on board.
And following the naming ceremony, of course, it has the first trek around the British Isles, basically. You've got Newcastle, Belfast, the Isle of Man, Liverpool, the Holyhead, Portbury. Again, you can also, indeed, I think before the whole wrap-up, watch the Fleet of the Fastnet yacht race from that perspective. But presumably, yeah, all of the tickets have gone for this maiden voyage.
Well, they are very close to going. So there are one or two left, but I mean, literally, please, if you are considering it, and it is only at the weekend, but there are very, very few tickets left. But we will see what we can do to squeeze you on, if that's at all possible. But you're quite right in terms of demand for the two cruise ships that we have. It has been extraordinary over this summer period and into autumn. But there are still some availability, but not very much.
So folk who are listening to this, they've had their appetite whetted, no pun intended, by the seafaring voyages of obviously Discovery and, of course, the latest one, the Spirit of Adventure, which launches. Where should people actually go to find out further details about Saga and their cruisers?
So come to our website first and foremost, thesaga.co.uk, and you will see very clearly, the itineraries that we've got. So for the month of August, it is round our beautiful island and to the smaller islands like the Isles of Scilly and so on, as you've mentioned, and the Isle of Man, which is just wonderful. I mean, people who have been on our ships, I was on, as I mentioned, just a couple of weeks ago, who know our country quite well, have never really seen it from the sea. And it is a totally different experience. And it is wonderful. And calling into ports that they've been to before, but are experiencing a different side of.
And Nick, you've obviously been with the company now for a few months. I mean, it was October when I think you joined or appointed Chief Executive Officer from that point of view. You have been Group Strategy Officer, etc. Exciting times, presumably, for the cruise industry.
A really exciting times. I mean, we have been, it's been a terrible time for every company and it's not been an easy time for Saga either. But we really do feel that we have come through this. We are stronger now as a business. We're still smiling. We've curbed with every curveball. Cope with every curveball that has come our way, and there may well be more, as we know, along the way. But we really do feel very optimistic about the future, and I'm just so delighted that at long last we're up and running and can't wait to invite guests on board.
Fantastic, Nick. It's been fantastic sharing some thoughts with your good self. I think resilient is one of those words which has been, if anything, overused over the last few months, but certainly Saga's demonstrated that in spades. Have a splendid opening voyage, a splendid launching ceremony. I'm sure it will be absolutely fantastic. Will it be presumably available on most of the people who want to view it visually? Will they be able to go online and actually sort of see clips on YouTube and various other things as well?
Yes, and Facebook as well. So it will be. You can just sort of type in our naming ceremony and you will be able to find it. So we're hoping lots of people see it and experience it. It's not the classic naming ceremony in terms of long speeches that frankly no one really wants to sit through. It's short and sharp, and then wonderful videos of incredible personalities that have joined us on voyages past, present and in the future will do so as well. It's a really, really fun thing to look at.
And is there a backup just in case the bottle doesn't actually break?
Oh, please don't.
Just put it out
there. Don't tempt fate. This is so important to us. So, no, I'm not going to answer that question.
Okay. I'm sure it will. It'll be fantastic.
It'll be amazing. Wonderful. We've rehearsed it, so we're hoping very much it all happens brilliantly.
Fantastic. Nick Stace, Chief Executive Officer for Saga Travel and Chief Strategy Officer. Huge thanks. Keeping on and have a fantastic day.
Thank you very much.
Time for another Zoomer on the Midweek Drive for Siren Radio and southsidebroadcasting.podbeam.com. Keeping the COVID-19 bugs at bay.
Well, are we beginning to move off the screen and onto the scene to quote an interesting sort of concept as we begin to head back to some form maybe of normality, despite the contrasting views we're getting about Freedom Day and what it means for us and various other factors as well. The fact of the matter is, it does seem that according to recent research from the Cambridge One-to-One Diet and the Cambridge Weight Plan, that we actually have an issue, or many of us are having issues about whether we've gained weight during lockdown, whether we're concerned about our body image, our body appearance. Maybe we've actually even adjusted our views with respect to the screen time we've been using and so on. Let's talk about this in further detail, specifically with two fabulous individuals. First of all, psychotherapist and life coach. That's the wonderful Andre Radmull. How are you, Andre?
Hi, good to be with you.
Excellent. And we've also got a nutritionist from the One-to-One Diet by Cambridge Weight Plan. That's Mark Gilbert. How are you, Mark?
I'm good, thanks.
Excellent. Andre, if we can turn to you first in terms of the general feeling about anxiety and, let's be honest, we're never going to get back to life as it was pre-pandemic. There are always going to be changes with respect to that. It'd be crazy to actually say we were going to go instantly back to that format. But as more and more of us are beginning to move back to offices, back to workplaces and so on, is it a case of there is anxiety about our body image?
Yeah, absolutely. It would seem from our research with the One-to-One Diet by Cambridge Health Weight Plan that 42% of people actually feel quite uneasy about their appearance as they come out of lockdown, and only 10% of people feel great. So it would seem that there's a lot of people with this anxiety about how other people are going to perceive them.
Yeah, it's interesting that 29% also feel like covering up in baggy clothes, elasticated waistbands, and so on and so forth. Has it been a mixture of, despite the fantastic advocates that have been working through YouTube and so on, say keep fit, keep healthy, do the exercise and so on, that many of us have actually sort of just decided to kind of maybe engage in comfort food, maybe the stresses of life in general has kind of proven to be too much, etc. A bit like a kind of, I won't use the word holiday because that would be crass, but in terms of an expanded period where we're literally sort of working by ourselves and left by ourselves, we've allowed obviously the pounds to gather.
I would say from a psychological point of view that there's two things that trigger that. One is isolation. People have been more isolated. And the second thing is stress. There's been generally a very kind of high level of stress through the pandemic. So I think those two things do tend to contribute to things like comfort eating and as we've seen, weight gain.
Yeah. Let's turn over to Mark. I mean, Mark, as a nutritionist, obviously within the One-to-One Diet by Cambridge Weight Plan, you've got more than 20 years experience in sports nutrition, clinical nutrition, health, etc. So what advice would you give to somebody who might be listening to this who might sort of feel, I've got 3 or 4 days to go. Should I just crash diet? No, presumably.
Well, I mean, people got into habits over this lockdown, and no one expected these various lockdowns to last this long. And obviously, people have developed habits that in most cases, because 81% of people have gained weight, in most cases, the combination of either not moving as much or eating the wrong kinds of foods has caused this. And there has been a bit of a trend of people having indulgent food, the so-called comfort food. So those are the things, the only way to reverse that process is to develop habits that, you know, will take your weight in the other direction, obviously. And the one thing we do, and we're focusing on the psychological aspect of this. And fortunately, I mean, we have 8,000 consultants around the country, and most of them have been through a weight loss experience. And they work with people every day that have issues with their weight. So we're really well placed to support and take care of people and get them through the process and get them developing the kinds of habits that are going to improve their health and appearance over time. And I wouldn't say crash diet, but there's nothing wrong with losing weight quickly. And the latest research refutes this kind of idea that if you lose weight too quickly, you gain it all back. It's actually a motivating factor. And some of the some research out of Oxford suggests that. So crash dieting is probably a bad term to use, but losing the weight quickly is actually a good thing, and it keeps people motivated. And good thing we've got is because you get a relationship with your consultant over time, and we've got quite a bit of new research to show this. We've got 3, 4, 5 year maintenance of weight loss, because that's the hardest part. Losing weight, most people have probably been on a diet where they lose a bunch of weight and then they put it back on. The hard part is to keep the weight off over time. And that's something we're really specializing at. And we've got some great research, again, out of Oxford and some Scandinavian research, et cetera, where we've got 3, 4, 5 years maintenance of weight loss.
You mentioned good habits. The first time I actually heard that term being used in sporting interests was actually by Terry Venables, who was actually in charge back in 1996, of course, when, of course, we had another European Championship adventure. But that's another line. And I suppose it is that sort of essence. I mean, Venables was referring to, obviously, doing the basics, doing the simple things and making sure that they're done fairly regularly. Presumably, Mark, that is something which is essential. It's just like, you know, don't stock up on the carbs, on the pastas, on the fizzy drinks, etc. Literally avoid those, get into the habit of actually good nutrition.
Absolutely. Good habits will bring success in most aspects of life, obviously. The other thing is we try to make it as easy as possible to make the right choice. We've got nutritionally complete foods we offer. There's also regular food and recipes, etc. But everything's designed so that it's very quick to prepare, or you just open a package. So it makes the choice between just grabbing something out of the cupboard that may not be nutritionally complete and maybe high in calories. Rather, you can choose a product of ours and they're correctly formulated to make sure you're getting what you need and not what you don't need.
And Andre, this seems a fairly crass question, but presumably the relationship between the way in which people view themselves, their own body image, the way in which they actually feel physically, of course, inevitably will have a key impact on our well-being and physical and psychological well-being, I should have thought.
Yeah, the two things are really two sides of the same coin. They're very interrelated. So if people don't feel good about their appearance, if they are particularly worried about how others might judge them harshly, that's going to impact on things like their self-esteem and their confidence. So there's no doubt that the two are very interconnected.
Presumably one, that's O-N-E, two, as in the number two, or the digit two, I should say, One Diet. That's onetoonediet.com will be the best place to actually go to, Mark, for further details about the One to One Diet by Cambridge Weight Plan.
Absolutely, yes. You can go to the website and you can find a consultant near you or remotely, and you can just have a chat with them, no obligation. And if it feels right, then they'll get you on track.
Makes perfect sense. And it's been fantastic sharing some thoughts with both of you today, gentlemen. Andre Radmal, a psychotherapist and life coach, and Mark Gilbert, nutritionist, and the One-to-One Diet by Cambridge Weight Plan. Huge thanks. Be well and keep on keeping on.
Thanks.
Well, you may not actually think it if you've been listening to some of the antics of some of the unfortunate followers of England over the last few days, of course, but it does seem as though people still prefer to actually maintain a certain level of politeness. And indeed, when polled, a quarter of 2,000 UK adults who were surveyed by Marcus by Goldman Sachs deemed it rude to hang up the phone on a cold caller, with a further 1 in 10 thinking it rude not to answer their questions. Now, certainly that it might seem fine, but when you actually bear in mind that some of those cold callers could be scammers, maybe it's not so fine. So we're delighted to welcome two excellent people to actually discuss this issue. First of all, the head of delivery and risk at Marcus by Goldman Sachs in the UK. That's wonderful. Sarah Card. How are you, Sarah?
Very well. Thank you, Alex. Very well. Thank you for having us.
Excellent. And we also have, from, of course, top etiquette authority to Brett's, the fabulous Liz Wise. How are you, Liz?
Very well, thank you, Alex.
Excellent. Now, we've politely introduced each other. We've connected on that basis. We've worked on that system fine. Liz, talk to us a bit about this research and why, in particular, this kind of impacts in terms of the way that people would actually sort of feel, oh, well, you might want my bank details, but should I tell you? Whatever.
Yes, I think British politeness does make us more vulnerable. As fraudsters become more sophisticated, they're very, very good at deploying conventional sort of British small talk techniques as a way of extracting information from the people they call. Small talk's a very good way. It's very subtle, it's very nuanced, and we're all very good at it. We're very good at extracting information about each other through small talk. And if someone is good at it, they can make you feel very relaxed and communicative. And that's dangerous because that's when you begin to let your guard down, and you might be lulled into a sense of false security. So I think the first most important thing is that you need to seize the initiative when you're called. It's fine to answer questions monosyllabically and politely, but you need to immediately put the ball back into your court by asking them questions, questioning who they are, questioning their credentials, where they come from, what's the nature of their business, why they're calling you. Right. So you go from being passive to being active, and that's the most important thing of all.
Sarah, were you surprised by the research? Were you surprised by the findings? Or did you think, well, yeah, I mean, that's how con merchants work. They kind of gain your trust by engaging in the minor points and then they move on from there.
Yeah, I mean, certainly as technology has advanced and security controls have got stronger, certainly we've seen that fraudsters are having to become more sophisticated to target people. And, you know, it certainly I've seen that unwanted callers are using confidence, charm and urgency to create a sense of panic and with people. Certainly the research did show, and I think I was surprised to see that, you know, nearly half people experience these type of things at least once a month. That certainly was surprising from the research. And I think that's why it's so important with this campaign, you know, keeping our customers and prospective customers and indeed your listeners, everybody safe from fraud is so important. And through this campaign, we really want to raise awareness of fraudulent activity and arm people with tips on how to prevent these scams from happening.
I was intrigued to find that it was 18 to 24 year olds who faced more near misses compared to 35 to 54 year olds. And indeed, over 55s are less so. So in a sense, does that suggest that the longer in the tooth one is, the less likely one is to fall through a scam? I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, that certainly was surprising to us as well. And there wasn't anything in the research to suggest why younger people were more susceptible to this. I think what it does show is that fraud doesn't discriminate at all. And it's an increasing universal problem, which is why it's so important, really, that, you know, you spread the word, we tell friends and family, and we communicate about this. One of the things that the research also touched into was the emotional impact that these type of, you know, potential scams or even these scams have on people. 34% of people that we researched didn't even tell anyone that they'd been a victim. So, you know, it is really important that people, you know, really spread the word and talk about this problem.
And Liz, from your own point of view, you talked about going from passive to active. Is that the key thing? Is it just a case of, well, thank you very much, but no? I mean, you know,
Well, yes, Yes, I think going from passive to active is absolutely fundamental. But I think also you can interrogate the person. You can suggest that you're not comfortable and that you'd like to phone them back. And then you can hang up and check the number on the company's website and do a call back. That way, yes, you're alerting them to the fact that you're suspicious, and no legitimate caller would ever object to that. I mean, it's a perfectly reasonable way of maintaining your own security. And I think always with these calls, refer to other people, enlist other people, say, I can't make this decision on my own. I need to discuss it with my partner, my accountant, my financial advisor, whatever. That's going to be a red flag for a fraudster.
Sarah, clearly we're talking about telephone calls here. I mean, are we back on that as a vogue for potential consensus? I thought it was all internet and web-based scamming these days, which is obviously, again, another sort of range of things that need to be effectively dealt with.
I mean, certainly, you know, your listeners can find out more information on how to keep themselves safe online at our website at marcus.co.uk /security. But yeah, I mean, obviously that, you know, fraudsters are becoming increasingly sophisticated and, you know, online security is not the only way that fraudsters are finding this information. You know, social engineering and gathering data is an important part of a fraud's armory, which is why these telephone calls are, you know, one of the things that fraudsters having to resort in doing, because technology is becoming stronger. And unfortunately, you know, fraudsters can't just break into websites and data now and gather this information. They're having to extract it from people through charm and pleasant conversations, as Liz was saying. And the important thing is that we recognize when that is. And it's hard. It's very difficult to tell if a call is genuine or not, which is why, you know, these top tips that, you know, we've teamed together with Brett to do are so helpful.
And just remind us, sorry, you mentioned it there, where is the best place to go to find out further details about this particular survey and indeed those top tips that Liz has excellently put together?
Yeah, please go to our website at marcus.co.uk/security. You can find lots of information about how to stay safe online and obviously to read the Debrett's guide on good manners and how to prevent unwanted callers and potential scammers.
Sarah Card, Head of Delivery and Risk at Marcus by Goldman Sachs in the UK, of course. And Liz Wise from Etiquette Authority Debrett's, huge thanks. We've politely said thank you. Farewell. Hopefully we'll see you again, but in the not too distant future.
Thanks, Alex.
Thank you. Goodbye.
Now, it's fair to say that we're always delighted when we can actually find out a little bit more about the history of food and various other elements relating to that. So it's a special delight to be able to welcome back to the programme award-winning food historian and indeed ace artist and founder of AVM Curiosities, of course, the fabulous Tasha Marks. How are you, Tasha?
I'm very well. Thank you for having me today.
Excellent. Now, one of the reasons we're here is to discuss the whole notions of how we kind of get confused over the origins of food. I mean, I never realized, for instance, that New York cheesecake was actually from ancient Greece, or indeed that fish and chips actually owe a lot to Jews in Portugal. So, I mean, what led you to this whole sort of exploration of cultural histories in your own sort of line, Tasha?
Well, I was challenged by Hein Cognac to find ingredients and recipes and foods with unexpected origins, because they're a French cognac company, but they have a British founder. So where else, you know, do you see this idea of unexpected origins and surprising heritages? And actually, I found out they're everywhere. There's hundreds, if not thousands of them. I mean, when we look at British food, we are looking at European recipes. And when we look at European recipes, we're looking at ingredients from all around the world. So really, food doesn't have any borders.
And this all goes on to the whole sort of consideration of, again, one world, one culture from that point of view. You mentioned, obviously, Hein Cognac's aspect. I mean, that, again, might surprise a number of people, as you said, that it originates from Dorset.
Yes. So for cognac to be cognac, it has to be made in cognac in France. However, Hein has this very unique style of cognac called Early Landed, where they have a special arrangement because their founder was English, that part of the liquid is aged in a barrel in the UK before it's being blended and bottled in France. And this sort of celebrates this idea of a very French product, but having British roots. So, and there's lots of things like that where they have part of them makes them a national dish of one country, but their ingredient or their main ingredient is from much further afield. Take something like apple pie. We think of as American as apple pie, but actually apples originated in Kazakhstan. So you never know where things actually come from.
Well, that was one that certainly caught my eye insofar as I could see a number of agents for America certainly sort of being quite taken aback to find that in light of recent sort of military excursions to there, that maybe they were actually sort of going back to the home of the original modern apple and so on. But what about things like as English as shepherd's pie? I mean, shepherd's pie without mashed potatoes, that's another sort of interesting one that I found.
Yeah, so actually potatoes originate from Peru. So and actually potatoes are a fairly recent introduction in terms of the history of English food. They only came to England in the 1600s, along with tomatoes, which came from South America. So I mean, when potatoes were first introduced to the UK, they one of the things they tried to sell them as was aphrodisiacs, because people were so confused by this strange vegetable.
Yeah, best not go there, but let's stay with the potato and move on to fish and chips, because that also has got an interesting background. I mean, it was, of course, back in the 1930s, I think it was one of the quick and wholesome hot food meals that was available for the messes. I think that's when I seem to recall it was first kind of put out. But long before then, of course, apparently we have Portugal to thank in particular for our current sort of incarnation of the fish and chip.
Yeah, so the humble fish chapo is actually has origins in Spain and Portugal, and in particular, it was Jewish immigrants from Portugal who first brought this dish over to the UK. And this idea of the ritual of the Friday night dinner, fish on a Friday, came from those people. And there's also some evidence that the chips had a sort of function. So this idea that the chips would help keep the fish fresher for longer if you didn't finish it and it went over to the Saturday, so which is the Jewish day of rest. So this sort of idea of fish and chips having a function to it, as well as for us, you know, a payday treat, something to celebrate the end of the working week, and something that is really a British institution, but with loads of different ways of looking at it, really.
Our eating habits tend to change partly as a result of fashion, partly as a result of culture and so on. And clearly there's a big push to a more vegan diet, a more appropriate vegetable diet, to actually sort of go away from meat eating and so on. I mean, is this something which historically you think actually we are living in interesting times as our diets are tending to be changed and adjusted?
I mean, absolutely, though. I mean, something like vegetarianism has been around for hundreds, if not thousands of years, because I mean, we are omnivores, but we don't need meat. We have other complex proteins that are part of our diets now. And actually, a lot of cultures have much less of a sort of meat eating habit. If we look outside of Europe to places like India or Africa, there's a lot less emphasis on the meat part of the diet. But I mean, vegetarianism has been on the rise solidly since around the 18th century. And certainly in the West, we have this idea of food trends where we preserve the exclusivity of certain foods by having this constant cycle of what's in vogue. But that really comes from a culture of food where we do very excitingly have everything available to us whenever we want it, which is the global food landscape we have before us.
Back in 2012, I was quite surprised to find a number of athletes who were saying that they love to, after they finish their competitions, actually go off to the local hamburger store and engage in that. But it seems that actually we can go back to the first Olympic Games in 776 BC and find that athletes were keen to actually engage with cheesecake. Is this the case?
Yeah, so put down that hamburger, have a cheesecake. So the origins of cheesecake have been traced back to ancient Greece. And they found a fair amount of evidence that it was cheesecake was served to the first athletes at the first Olympic Games in 776 BC, which means that cheesecake is at least almost 3,000 years old. And also, you know, it was given as a sort of energy giver, like an energy bar. So next time you go to the gym, definitely pop a cheesecake in your bag.
I love the quote you actually used, Tertia, from Gertrude Stein, which went, "A rose is a rose is a rose, but so too a Cornish pasty is a Spanish empanada to a Jamaican patty." So maybe, again, there are lots of similarities in terms of this. Just briefly returning to Hein Cognac, I mean, clearly we've talked about the way that that's actually developed over its year, etc. Do you think that Hein Cognac will remain in terms of the 21st, 22nd centuries for future historians to say, yes, well, ever since that founding in 1763, it's maintained its originality?
Yeah, absolutely. And also cognac is one of those things that it just gets better with time. So that's very exciting.
And finally, what about just briefly things such as the Melton Mowbray pork pie, or indeed the other sort of the notion of Cornish cream? And clearly, we've headed off politically into a different direction from Europe as far as branding is actually concerned. Do you think that'll still be maintained? Will it be lost, or will it be a case of, well, it'll be absorbed into our cultural lives?
I hope so, because the EU have protections over certain nationalistic dishes that now we have left the EU, we don't have the same protections. However, I mean, that is the special thing about food, is people always, there's a sense of identity when it comes to our food, of a certain place and a certain time. And that is something that will always be sort of ingrained in us as people, wherever you come from. It has something to say about your identity and who you are. And food is political, but it's also personal. I think that's what makes it exciting.
Ties in with, of course, your work with AVM Curiosities and that whole side of things there. AVM, of course, stands for what exactly, Tasha?
It stands for Animal Vegetable Mineral.
There was, I think it was audiovisual mechanisms, but no, animal vegetable mineral, but it's always important from that point of view. But presumably for people who wish to find out more details about this particular study, would it be hine.com would be the website to actually go to?
It would be indeed, yeah.
Excellent. So you can also follow Hein Cognacs on Instagram as well, which is even more wonderful. So it leads us with two final questions. First of all, have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us on the programme today?
What was that? Sorry?
Have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us? It's a customer satisfaction.
Yes. Oh, yes.
It's a 21st century phenomenon. Excellent.
It's been lovely, yes.
And therefore, Tasha, I take it you'll be kind enough to return in the not-too-distant future and keep us appraised of how food and fragrance as artistic mediums can all interconnect together and actually help our cultural aspects thrive. Will you come back?
Absolutely.
Moray, Scotland, the borough of Mid Devon, or indeed Denbighshire? What do they have in common? Well, lowest frequency of theft claims in Great Britain, which is great news if you're living in Scotland, Great Britain, or Mid Devon. But what about those of us who actually aren't in those particular areas? And particularly if you happen to be in Lambeth, South London, you might not find it pleasing to know the rate of car thefts and so on and so forth that a recent co-op survey has actually produced. So we're delighted then to be able to actually address this very vexing issue of car theft and car crimes to welcome to the programme the ace, former car dealer, in fact, and indeed TV presenter and consumer champion extraordinaire, Dominic Littlewood, to us. How are you, Dominic?
I'm very well, Alex, and thanks for having me.
Good. So, I mean, one of the challenging things about car theft, and I think most of us have had some kind of experience, or certainly of possibly sort of car breakages or issues related to that, is how frequent it can actually occur and how problematic it actually is. Is it getting worse? Is it a case of it doesn't matter about how fancy the car is and how many electronic devices you've actually got protecting it, it's still a target for crime?
You've hit the nail on the head there, Frankie. It doesn't matter what car it is. I mean, in the top 10 cars that are stolen, at the top, in the top three, it's a Fiesta, Focus and a Vauxhall Corsa. But you've also got in the same top 10 list, the Range Rover Evoque and Audi A3. So it doesn't really matter about the value of the car or the size of it. Thieves will steal cars. Sometimes they steal them just for the joyride. Other times they're stolen for order because they might be stripped down or possibly containered and shipped abroad. And the reason I'm here today, of course, Alex, is because the Co-op Insurance has released new data which shows the car crime hotspots over the last 4 years. And I've got a list of 20 hotspots. But what's interesting is there's a link. You can type in Google, just Co-op Park Smart Tool. You can put in a postcode or a street name, and it will tell you exactly how many crimes have been committed. Their car crimes, this is, of course, in the last 6 months. Now, you mentioned Lambeth being number one on the list. Well, that's where my house is. And I went in on the tour last night and had a look at it. And unfortunately, mine is very bad. There's one area which has had 7 car thefts in the last 6 months. And when I looked at it, it's very, very close to a supermarket car park. So putting two and two together, hopefully it's correct. You think, well, OK, that's probably because people are in spending, you know, an hour doing their shopping. And, you know, their car's being targeted then. But there's lots of things we can do, Alex, to try and put the thief off or make his or her job of damaging or stealing your car a lot harder.
Now, allowing for those kind of things, I mean, clearly that's one of the key aspects we're looking for today, because, I mean, the knock-on effect, obviously, of having high areas of crime in your areas, obviously insurance premiums go up, all sorts of things sort of impact on that. So how can people effectively sort of look, Dominic, to really sort of make the car, which is second most expensive possession for most of us, less attractive to potential criminals and car thieves?
Second most expensive after the wife, is that right, Alex?
I won't go there, Dominic. I'm not going to even enter that particular aspect.
Okay, but, no. Some of this is common sense, but sometimes we just need to be reminded. Okay. When you leave your car, particularly if it's overnight, try and leave the wheels on full lock, because some thieves, when they steal cars, will break in and they try and push them down the road to a quieter spot. If the car's wheels are on full lock and the steering lock is engaged, that makes their job that much harder. So that's quite a good little tip. It's an obvious one to say don't leave anything visually in the car which they might want to steal. So phones, laptops, handbags, expensive coats, sunglasses, even the loose change in the centre console. Sometimes cars get broken into for that. But on the flip side of it, do leave visual things that make it look like you care. So steering locks, for example, you know, £20-30 to buy. If a thief looks at your car, sees that on there, he knows it's another obstacle he's got to overcome if he wants to take the car. Where you park is quite important. Always try and park it underneath some bright lights, street lights, floodlights, or CCTV cameras, or where there's pedestrian traffic, because that's quite a good deterrent. And the other thing that's happening quite a lot now is people are thinking they look at their car, they're going into shops, but there's these jamming devices that jam the signal between your car key and the door. And you think you've locked the car and you haven't. You've actually left it unlocked, but that also means it's unalarmed. So when you use your car key to lock the doors, just physically lift the door handle and make sure they are locked. In slow moving traffic, if you've got your windows down, if the weather's hot, or if it's convertible and your roof's down, don't have something that's easily grabbed off a seat, because someone going past on these electric scooters now can grab that and they'll be gone like milk on a Weetabix, Alex, you know, completely disappear. Just be cautious, be sensible, think like a thief, and try and make it hard for these people to do what they're up to.
We're in the decade which is seeing a gradual shift, again, a mandatory shift from petrol to electric vehicles and so on. Are there any signs that effectively car crime is always going to be with us? Or is it a case of, well, if you switch into electric vehicles, et cetera, there are other sort of issues at work there? Or is it just a case of, well, unfortunately, theft is one of those unfortunate byproducts of the human condition?
Well, I think you summed it up in everything you said there. I mean, we haven't got crystal balls. So we don't know exactly how it's going to evolve, but cars are getting more hybrids and electrics now. We're obviously seeing a lot more catalytic converters being stolen. That crime's gone up sixfold in the last year. Who knows what with new cars, what will happen next? Will people start to steal the batteries? You know, will they start stealing, you know, well, you can't steal radios anymore. At least we've evolved from that because they're all built into the dashboard. But I think we're always, as cars evolve and they become a lot more sophisticated, so do the people out there who are up to the crimes. They've got the equipment and the technology now to sort of get past a lot of it. So again, it boils down to, you know, we can make it harder. And that's why I'm trying to sort of push out there. You know, let's not give them an easy ride.
And if people actually want to find out more details, Dominic, about the co-op survey or indeed your top tips for actually preventing car crime, where would you point them?
Well, the website address is coop.co.uk/insurance/hub/park-smart. That's a bit of a mouthful. So basically just go to Google and put in co-op park smart tool and do it wherever you live with your postcode or a road where you park regularly. Have a look. It's quite interesting because you can see exactly where the crimes are taking place and how many over the last 6 months.
Fascinating. And again, slightly worrying at the same time as well, but hopefully not something to lose too much sleep over if you actually look to do some of those key aspects that Dominic suggested and that we put into place from that point of view. Dominic Littlewood, TV consumer champion extraordinaire, as we say, and indeed former car dealer extraordinary. Many thanks indeed. Take care and speak soon.
Thanks, Alex. Have a good day.